Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Ukrainian rebels begin a controversial election, and in Burkina Faso, opposition leaders reject an army takeover. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine begin voting today in controversial elections that Kiev and the West say they will not recognize. The separatists, who control parts of eastern Ukraine's Luhansk and Donetsk regions, are holding elections for leadership and legislative bodies in those areas. The Ukrainian military says, meantime, there is intensive movement of troops and weapons from Russia into the separatist-controlled areas where the voting is occurring, although the report has not been immediately verified. News agencies report as many as 20 unmarked trucks, some with anti-aircraft guns, are heading toward the government-held airport in rebel-held Donetsk, but it's unclear whether they are new or existing forces in the rebel-held region. In Burkina Faso, citizens are taking to the streets again today, this time in protest of the army, which the political opposition says is trying to confiscate the people's ousting of President Blaise Compaoré. VOA's Anne Look has the latest.
Burkina Faso's political opposition held a brief public rally Sunday in Ouagadougou before heading into closed-door talks with the country's military leaders. After Mr. Compaoré's resignation, two military officers each made statements claiming to be in charge. The military sorted it out Saturday, naming one of them Lieutenant Colonel Yakuba Isaac Zita as head of the transition. The opposition has accused the army of hijacking the people's revolution. Zita has pledged to hold democratic elections, quote, as soon as possible, but has given no specifics. Anne Luck, VOA News, Dakar.
A bomb attack in the Lahore region of Pakistan has killed at least 55 people and more than 100 others are wounded. The attack took place near the Wagah border crossing with India, where a lowering of flag ceremony is held every evening. A Pakistani militant faction claimed responsibility in a statement emailed to media outlets. A new car bomb attack targeting Shiite pilgrims in Baghdad has killed at least 12 people. The blast today came at a tent where water and tea were being served. The explosion injured 29 people. Israel has closed two border crossings with Gaza. Kerem Shalom and Erez crossings were closed today, according to Israeli Defense Forces, after a rocket was fired into Israel from the Palestinian side, which caused neither damage nor injuries. The military says humanitarian aid will be allowed to go through the Erez crossing. The rockets are the second strike since Israel's 50-day war against the Gaza militants came to a close. A war crimes tribunal in Bangladesh has handed down the death penalty to a senior leader of the country's largest Islamist party for war crimes. Amir Qasim Ali was found guilty on charges stemming from the nation's war for independence against Pakistan in 1971. Abdulrahman Hawladar worked as prosecutor.
14 charges were brought against accused Amir Qasim Ali, and 11 charges were proved beyond reasonable doubt. And in two charges, he was convicted and awarded death sentence.
A group of Bangladesh liberation fighters rallied outside the court demanding the death sentence for the 62-year-old media tycoon. Tens of thousands of people flooded into a coastal town in Western Australia this weekend, marking the departure of the anniversary of the first fleet of troops to the battlefields of World War I. Phil Mercer filed this report from Sydney.
100 years ago, the whaling town of Albany, south of Perth in Western Australia, would have been the last site of home for many of the young men sailing off to war. Many would end up on the beaches of Gallipoli, where Australia and New Zealand, two former British colonies, fought for the first time as independent nations. There was carnage on the battlefield. Troops from Britain, France and Turkey suffered terrible losses, while more than 8,000 Australians died at Gallipoli. Thousands of people have gathered in Albany in Western Australia for a parade and a memorial service to remember the heroism of the Anzacs. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
British billionaire Richard Branson says he is determined to find out what went wrong with his space tourism aircraft that crashed Friday, killing one pilot, seriously injuring another. Authorities with the Kern County Sheriff's Office have identified the pilot killed in the accident as 39-year-old Michael Asbury, the pilot who is critically injured, 43-year-old Peter Siebold. Siebold is reported to have sustained moderate and to major injuries and was airlifted to a nearby hospital. Unidentified gunmen have ambushed a group of police officers during a security operation in northern Kenya, killing at least seven. Officials said Saturday at least 12 officers are still missing. One report said two civilians were also killed. There is little information on the attack in the Turkana area or who was behind it. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We have made a call to all the political stakeholders and civil society in Burkina Faso to work together in a spirit of consensus and responsibility.
The African Union calls on the Burkina Faso military to allow civilians to lead the transition.
The army is Burkina Faso's army. The army will play a big role as far as security is concerned.
Why is the opposition Burkina Faso saying the military has undertaken a coup d'etat? We will try to find an answer.
According to the reports we got, there were some two attacks in two different towns, in Mombasa and about 100 kilometers away in Malindi.
And seven people are killed in an attack at a Kenyan military base. We'll have details, those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The spokesman for the African Union says the organization is ready to work with leaders and stakeholders in Burkina Faso in an order to expedite the transition process to quickly return to constitutional rule, according to El Gassim One. He told me earlier that the AU has called on the Burkinabe military to create the condition to ensure civilians lead the transition in an effort to restore constitutional order.
Well, we are closely following the situation. We have taken note of the resignation of President Compaoré, and we have made a call to all the political stakeholders and civil society in Burkina Faso to work together in a spirit of consensus and responsibility in order to agree on a civilian-led transition that would culminate in the holding of free, fair, and transparent elections. We believe that it is important that the defense and security forces place themselves at the disposal of civilian authorities who should lead the transition, and that the defense and security forces should act in a republican spirit.
Will the African Union give a member state like Burkina Faso a specific time period within which to return the country, you know, to constitutional rule?
There is no specific time, but the practice is to ensure return to constitutional order as quickly as possible. And we believe that a successful transition in Burkina Faso should be a transition that is led by civilians. And we are calling on the defense and security forces to facilitate such a process.
What about the role of ECOWAS? How is the coordination between the African Union and ECOWAS since this happened within the purview of the sub-regional bloc ECOWAS? What is the cooperation there to address this specific challenge?
Well, ECOWAS and the African Union belong both to what we call the African Peace and Security Architecture, which provides for a specific role to be played by the regional economic communities as part of the overall African Peace and Security Agenda. And we do work closely together on all issues of common interest. And the delegation that is currently in Ouagadougou is a delegation comprising representatives of the AU, the United Nations, and ECOWAS. And indeed, we do work closely together.
So what is the aim and objectives of the AU mission to help resolve this challenge in Burkina Faso?
Well, the aim is, of course, to assist the Burkinabe stakeholders to address the current challenges facing them, especially the political crisis. The delegation is still in Ouagadougou, so we are looking forward to its report so as to facilitate the next steps in the continent's response to the unfolding situation in Burkina Faso.
What is the AU's message to the people of Burkina Faso during this time?
Well, the message is one of readiness to support, assist the Burkinabe people and political and social stakeholders in achieving their aspirations to change, to the deepening of democracy. And in this respect, we believe they should continue to work together in a spirit of consensus and responsibility, and they should all support a civilian-led transition that would lead to the holding as soon as possible of elections in the country.
El Gassim Wan is a spokesman for the African Union. He spoke with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. For reaction regarding the current situation in Burkina Faso, I reached out to a leading member of the opposition coalition, Ablaze Ouedraogo. Ouedraogo told me that the protesters are not happy that the military appears to have hijacked their effort, which forced longtime leader Blaise Compaoré to flee into exile after stepping down last Friday.
The people of Burkina Faso have stand up and we have got the departure of Blaise Compaoré from the power. The victory is the people's victory. And we do consider, after the experience we had with the army in our country and in the other African countries, our preference is for the civilian to lead the transition and to lead the transitional period. For sure, the army is Burkina Faso's army. The army will play a big role as far as security is concerned, security and defense are concerned. We would like everybody to feel included in the transitional process. So there is no need to take long to understand that unless Burkina Faso complies with the agreements, with the protocols, with the conventions this country has signed at the international level, namely with the African Union, with the UN, with ECOWAS, Burkina Faso will quickly fall into a big embargo. And as you know, Burkina Faso is one of the poorest countries in this world. Our development depends mainly on the contribution we are getting from our partners, our friends from outside. So it is too risky to go through a military coup and to get the sanction. It is not necessary because the biggest loser will be once again the population. And we don't want the population who has got a victory to become the loser of the game.
So you think there's suspicion that the military will stay longer and not hand over power? Is that the suspicion?
I am saying we have a case, we have a situation. The people of Burkina Faso has made a victory getting rid of Blaise Compaoré. What we are saying, during the transitional period, it is fair to give a responsibility of the transitional period management to these people. And these people is composed of civilians. That's all.
If this is the case, who should lead this transition? Since some people say the military can provide a critical role in the country's stability, who are being proposed to lead the transition?
Nana, we are working on that. You will get the news very soon.
Is there a meeting with the military as part of this process?
No, this afternoon we are meeting at 4.
What are Burkinabes saying about this announcement that the military has taken over so far? What are they saying?
We are mad. And right now I am going to talk to the people. We have gathered, assembled in a place called Place de la Nation, where we used to meet. I'm going there. I am on my way there. We don't accept that the army take over.
Does that mean that they are going to keep on demonstrating and protesting until a civilian administration?
To put pressure on the army until they understand what they have to leave, to step aside.
So what will you be telling them?
I'm going to tell them to keep on going with the pressure.
Ablaze Ouedraogo is a leading member of the opposition coalition in Burkina Faso. He spoke with me from the Burkinabe capital, Ouagadougou. 7 people have been killed in an early morning attack at a military barracks in the Kenyan port city of Mombasa. This follows a similar incident on Saturday at a police station in the tourist resort of Malindi. David Ochani is the bureau chief of a major Kenyan daily newspaper, The Standard. My colleague Douglas Impoga reached him there to find out what happened.
According to the reports we got, there were some 2 attacks in 2 different towns, in Mombasa and about 100 kilometers away in Malindi. The most important attack happened on American barracks in Mombasa at a place called Nyali. And there was a separate attack nearly at the same time, around 5, in upon a police camp in Malindi. The one in Malindi led no casualties, but there was a group of about 20 people who attacked a military police barrack and tried to burn it down. They didn't kill anyone. But the most important attack, as I told you, was in Mombasa at the barracks today, around 4:30 a.m. this morning, where a similar group of people, around 20, tried to infiltrate the military barracks. And in the process of trying to do so, they encountered some resistance from the military, and they killed or they hacked one of the soldiers. 6 of the attackers were killed, but others fled.
Do we know, David, whether these attacks are related?
No, we do not know, because, number one, no group has claimed responsibility. The only relationship is the fact that they happened in similar fashion and almost at the same time and on similar facilities.
We, as you say, no group has claimed responsibility as yet.
So far, no group. I'm saying so far, there's no group that has claimed responsibility. And the state has also not tried to ascribe any responsibility so far. Although in the Mombasa attack, the local commissioner, Mr. Nelson Mara, tried to suggest that radicalized youths, religious youth, could have been behind it.
Radical youth could have been behind this. Why particularly Mombasa, in your view?
Yeah, that's the commissioner here is called Mr. Nelson Marwa. That's what he tried to suggest. And normally that's a way of trying to bring in Al-Shabaab, but they didn't say so directly. And in any case, Al-Shabaab itself has not claimed responsibility. But according to some of the military people who spoke to, they also suspect the attack on the barracks could have been an attempt to Al-Shabaab infiltrate the camp, seize guns, and maybe begin a gunfight that would lead into a bloodbath for their propaganda purposes.
Were any of the attackers apprehended?
Yes. According to Mr. Nelson Marwa, the commissioner, and even our own sources within the military, one attacker was arrested. And we do not know exactly what they had, because police have tried to discount all the claims we had. One of them had an improvised explosive device on him. We cannot confirm that, but those are the reports we got initially. Otherwise, all the attackers happened to be having knives or machetes, which were concealed as they were trying to infiltrate the military facility.
That was David Ochani, the bureau chief of a major Kenyan daily newspaper, The Standard. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Mombasa. Chinese authorities work to clarify their response to the West African Ebola outbreak at a time when governments around the world are trying to determine the best way to prevent the virus from reaching their shores. In China, there has been limited and at times contradictory information about the measures in place to respond to Ebola. VOA's William Ide reports from Beijing.
Last week, China's foreign ministry said that travelers from West African countries who showed no signs of the virus would be allowed to travel without restriction. But other government agencies and Chinese media reports have described a different policy. According to Chinese health authorities and interviews VOA has conducted, anyone visiting from the 3 Ebola-hit West African countries must self-quarantine for 3 weeks. But how the quarantine is implemented is not clear, and health officials are refusing to provide more information. Chinese media reports have given only rough details about the program. How authorities are monitoring at-risk individuals around the country remains unclear, including whether there are quarantines for Chinese health workers returning from West Africa. In the capital of China's southern Guangdong province of Guangzhou, which is the main point of entry for African visitors, the mayor reportedly has required that anyone arriving from the 3 countries should be given a mobile phone. According to the Southern Metropolis Daily, individuals must keep the phone on at all times for 21 days. In a news conference Friday in Beijing, the head of the African Affairs Department at China's Foreign Ministry, Lin Songtian, says healthy visitors from West Africa are welcome to come to China. Lin says that as far as he understands, there is no visa ban toward the 3 countries hit by Ebola. Earlier this week, the state-run Xinhua News Agency reported that Beijing authorities would suggest visitors self-quarantine. indicating that such quarantines would be voluntary. But on Friday, Lien said that anyone coming to the country is required to submit to health checks and surveillance by authorities. Lien says that China is also working together with international airlines, requiring them to report anyone on flights bound to China who shows symptoms of the disease or are suspected of carrying the disease. One source tells VOA that two students who recently came to China from Guinea got so frustrated with an imposed self-quarantine in a hotel that they ran away to Guangzhou. They were later tracked down by authorities and were not released until they finished their quarantine period. So far, China has yet to see a case of Ebola. There have been some scares, however, and earlier this month, without giving any real details, a health official in Guangdong abruptly announced that 43 individuals who were suspected to have Ebola had tested negative. The number of suspected cases has now risen to 50, according to a report in the China Daily Thursday. The report did not elaborate. Bill Eide, VOA News, Beijing.
The United Nations reports attacks on humanitarian workers are seriously hampering efforts to provide relief for hundreds of thousands of people who were forced to flee their homes in the Central African Republic. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Although the media and world at large appear to have forgotten the plight of millions of people in Central African Republic, the United Nations reports that war-torn country is still experiencing a huge humanitarian emergency and a displacement crisis. The latest figures show about 410,000 people have been forced out of their homes and are dependent on international aid. Added to these problems is the worsening violence and increased attacks against aid workers. This is making it more difficult and dangerous to reach those in desperate need of assistance. The United Nations reports 19 security incidents in which 8 national aid workers were killed took place between the start of the year and September. The number of incidents is increasing. The UN notes 7 more attacks against humanitarian aid workers occurred between October 7th and 19th alone. At the same time as this month's unprecedented attacks against humanitarian workers took place, UN Children's Fund spokesman Christophe Boulierac says dangers have been increasing for the population across the country.
Across the Central African Republic, more than 2.3 million children have been affected by the crisis since intense fighting reached Bangui last December, forcing nearly 1 million people to flee their homes. UNICEF has verified that 6 children died and 22 were injured in the 8-day intensification of fighting in the city earlier this month, including 2 children brutally killed after they were accused of spying. UNICEF also received reports that wounded children and pregnant women were not able to access hospitals because of roadblocks or because they feared being targeted.
Despite the growing violence, Boulierac says UNICEF is rushing critical supplies to thousands of children forced to flee their homes. The World Food Programme notes the security situation in CAR also is creating critical obstacles to its ability to distribute food. A recent joint assessment by WFP and the Food and Agriculture Organization finds the crisis has caused a sharp deterioration of the food security situation. WFP spokeswoman Elizabeth Beers says the outlook for the country is bleak.
We can see that food reserves in rural areas are estimated at 40 to 50% lower than average following recurring lootings and widespread insecurity. We can see also a decrease in the quantity and quality of meals in the country. This crisis has significantly worsened the food security in a country where already between one quarter and one third of the total population is food insecure.
WFP reports it was able to reach just over half of 480,000 people targeted for food distribution in the north of the country last month, and that it was forced to suspend such assistance in the capital, Bangui, on September 8th. Only in the past few days has WFP been able to resume food deliveries to 26,000 IDPs in the city. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And Nigeria has the highest rate of out-of-school children in the world, with about 10.5 million children. Over half of those children are girls, most of whom reside in northern Nigeria. Development experts say the situation can be reversed if local educators can remove obstacles that keep girls from going to school. Jennifer Edelman reports for VOA from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos.
Dr. Owen Escher says more girls are enrolled in primary education, but that does not necessarily mean they will finish or move on to secondary school. Eshet is the director of a youth-focused NGO in Lagos, Action Health Incorporated. He says the challenge is keeping girls in school until they finish or decide to continue to another level.
When we now look at retention and completion, then in those areas, you see that girls are still lagging seriously behind. You know, and when you look at transiting from primary school to junior secondary school, from junior secondary school to senior secondary school, from senior secondary school to tertiary education, in Northeast and Northwest Nigeria, especially, girls are still far, far behind.
Recent report released by the African Health, Human and Social Development Information Service. The states with the highest numbers of uneducated girls are Kebbi, Sokoto, Bauchi, Jigawa, Yobe, Zamfara, Katsina, and Gombe. The study attributes the problem in part to the dominance of male leaders. Escher says researchers asked community, traditional, and religious leaders in Borno and Bauchi states why they discourage girls from going to school.
They said, you see, if we allow these girls to go to school just like the way you are advocating, they'll become sexually active outside of marriage. And if they become sexually active outside of marriage, all this HIV you people are shouting about, they are likely going to be infected. So what we will prefer is let them have sex within marriage, where we can at least know who is their sexual partner, their husband and all of that. And then we said, okay, if that is so, why don't you want them to go to school? They say, no, we would like our girls to go to school, provided they are married.
Eshet pointed to other factors contributing to the poor education attainment of girls. They include ignorance, poverty that keeps parents from buying uniforms and books, and underinvestment by some government leaders in the education sector. While children and adolescents make up over 30% of Nigeria's population, one out of every three primary age children is out of school, and roughly one out of four junior secondary age children is out of school. To rectify this, he advocates for NGOs and government representatives to present education in a way those affected will understand by reaching out to them at the grassroots. Eshet says Muslim clerics and educated women would help out to build local support.
We must have what is called community level engagement on education. There are policies at the national level that states have signed on to, but in terms of engaging with the robust implementation of the policy at the grassroots level, at the community level, and I'm saying this coming from the backdrop of the work we've done in northern Nigeria, especially with trying to get married adolescent girls back into school.
Different strategies are being put in place to keep girls in school. For the past 7 years, Action Health Incorporated has been working in northeastern Nigeria to encourage married adolescent girls to return back to school. With funding support from the United Nations Population Fund, UNFPA, the organization collaborated with community leaders and some government agencies in the states to facilitate the enrollment of the girls. They provided creche for their babies within the school and also ensured availability of sanitation and clinics. If all boys and girls in Nigeria decide to go to school, there will not be enough classrooms and teachers for them. However, Escher says Nigerian leaders must devote more money and political support to education and begin to see it as a moral obligation the government owes its citizens. This is Jennifer Idiame reporting for Voice of America.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, November 2nd. Algerian club Antoine Setif has emerged the winner of the 2014 CAF Champions League. The Algerians won the prestigious championship on Saturday, despite being held 1-1 at home by AS Vita Club of Congo in the second leg of the final. Setif lifted the trophy on the away goal roll after drawing the first leg 2-2 in Kinshasa last weekend. Soufiane Youni scored for Setif after 49 minutes, and Lema Mabidi equalized 5 minutes later before a sellout 35,000 crowd in Bleda. For the victory, Antoine Setif smiled on with the top prize money of $1.5 million. Runner of PS Vita Club got a consolation prize of $1 million. For lifting the title, Antoine has won the tickets to the 2014 FIFA Club World Cup to be hosted by Morocco in December. The Algerians will also face the winner of the CAF Confederation Cup in the 2015 CAF Super Cup. Congratulations to Antoine Setif of Algeria. Turning to the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, African soccer's governing body, CAF, has denied reaching a deal with Morocco to postpone the tournament because of the Ebola pandemic. Last month, Morocco requested delaying the January 17th to February 8th Nations Cup over fears that the disease could spread to the North African nation. Moroccan daily Al Sabah, citing an authorized source, claimed in its Friday edition that a deal in principle had been reached to delay the competition at a meeting with CAF President Issa Hayatou on Wednesday. According to the newspaper, Hayatou showed himself open to accepting Morocco's request to defer the Nations Cup until June or even January 2016. But the article was rejected as completely untrue by a CAF spokesman. No official decision is expected to be made before today's Sunday's CAF Executive Committee meeting in Algiers. After the meeting, Hayatou will lead a delegation to Morocco for further talks. CAF is then expected to issue a statement clarifying the situation after weeks of wild media speculation. Analysts are looking at three likely scenarios. One, Morocco backs down and agrees to original hosting dates. Two, CAF agrees to postpone the tournament to mid-2015 or early 2016. And three, talks collapse, Morocco withdraws, and CAF seeks a new host. Of the countries approached as possible emergency hosts, Nigeria and Ghana are reportedly undecided, while Algeria, Egypt, South Africa, and Sudan decline. The Cup of Nations is crucial to CAF as each tournament generates $11.7 million from TV and marketing rights. It is the biggest cash injection into the Cairo-based Confederation, with the CAF Champions League and CAF Confederation Cup club competitions earning a combined $10.2 million annually. Meanwhile, Sierra Leone's soccer boss has expressed support for the Nations Cup postponement. President Aisha Johansson of the Sierra Leone Football Association, SLFA, says the association has used the money donated to it by World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, which had been intended to develop football infrastructure to drive charity projects raising awareness of how to avoid contracting Ebola. Johansson, one of just two female football association presidents, believes Morocco's fears of staging the Continental Championship in January with Ebola still on contained in West Africa are valid. Ebola has taken its toll on Sierra Leone's national team, which last month had a 50-hour round trip for a home game against the Democratic Republic of Congo that was instead played in Lubumbashi.
Hi, this is VOA's Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. You're listening to my friend Segun Dot on the spot Adeyemi and Nightline Africa Sports.
Let's now head to South Africa, where national team captain Sensu Meyiwa was laid to rest on Saturday. The remains of the Bafana Bafana and Orlando Pirates goalkeeper were buried
at the Heroes Acre Cemetery in Chesterville, KwaZulu-Natal. As the coffin descended, a police burglar performed a rendition of the last post. Meiwa's wife wept and appeared to be speaking to the slain goalkeeper as she threw a flower into the grave. Meiwa's father, Samuel, looked lost and forlorn and seemed to be confused after being handed the South African flag that was draped over Meiwa's coffin. A heavy rain then began to fall. As relatives approached the grave, they too began to weep. Among dignitaries at the burial were Kaizer Chiefs goalkeeper Itumeleng Khune, South Africa Football Association President Danny Jordan, Deputy Agriculture Minister Becky Sele, and Sports Minister Fikile Mbalula. A funeral service attended by thousands of fans was held earlier at the Moses Mabhida Stadium in Durban. Meiwa was shot and killed last Sunday evening while visiting his girlfriend, actress and singer Kelly Kumalo. Two men entered the house located some 30 kilometers south of Johannesburg, demanding cell phones and shot him before fleeing. On Friday, a man appeared in court in connection with Meiwa's killing. 25-year-old Zekunle Mbatha was arrested and charged with the killing of the goalkeeper. The National Prosecuting Agency said Mbatha will appear in the Boksburg Magistrate Court again on November 11th. And from Nigeria comes the report that Stephen Keshi has been reappointed as coach of African champion Nigeria, despite being sacked earlier this month. The reappointment was the latest twist in a long-running battle for control of the country's football federation. Keshi led the Super Eagles to the African title in 2013, but was sent packing on October 16th. After a string of poor performances, including a surprise defeat away to Sudan. But many believe that protracted political battles inside the Nigeria Football Federation, NFF, were behind his dismissal and his eventual reinstatement. There were reports on Thursday suggesting that President Goodluck Jonathan had intervened to order Keshi to be given a new contract. New NFF boss Amaju Pinnick, who emerged on top after an extended power struggle within the NFF, is seen as a Keshi rival, while the sports minister, Tami Danagogo, is known to be a supporter of the outspoken coach. The man named by Pinnick to lead the Super Eagles after Keshi's firing, Shaibu Amodu, had also come out in favor of Keshi's return for Nigeria's forthcoming matches. The caretaker coach said he did not have enough time to remake the squad that his predecessor had shaped. On Friday, the NFF Technical Committee said it had decided to accept Amodu's proposal for Keshi to be reinstated for Nigeria's next Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers against Congo and South Africa in November. Nigeria needs to not only win both matches, but beat Congo by a margin of 2 goals to stand any chance of qualifying automatically for the finals in Morocco next year. Finally, coach of Russian Premier League club FC Rostov has said he will not sign black players and joked that Ebola has spread to the club. Igor Gamula told the local media that the club had, quote, enough dark-skinned players, we've got 6 of the things, unquote, when asked in a post-match news conference about rumors that Rostov will sign a Cameroonian defender. Gamula also said that 5 of his Russian players were ill with high temperature and joked that the Ebola epidemic was the cause. Rostov midfielder Moussa Doumbia is from Mali, which has become the latest West African nation to record Ebola cases. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi, traveling in Kampala, Uganda this weekend.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll hook up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports, Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Sana, the cancer.
sana nze sichalosi sichalosi nze sichalosi ndi boss sichalosi dance dance yefaba vubuke mvumulo yefaba vubuke mvumulo akalero kansonga kakubye ndi mumundu ya chigoma sagala nyombo kubanga ino sawa ya nungu bagambe sagala nyombo ino sawa ya chikiri mwama sembera mulamu wasoba jangu fetale yansiri akulika nekazine nenzina mumama mulamu wachisera ato muziki zuri sana nekazine nenzina mumama mulamu wachisera ato muziki Tamu sana Nse sichalosi Sichalosi Nse sichalosi ndi boss Sichalosi Dance, dance Abange Unovula mugumbi Zengugami Kalimundeke nangi Kwenzi jukira muche mfuti Endoza tukubana Achuleka otada Nebakendi kakanga Itali musana, oh mama, oh la la, yeah. Oh agaliba,
enjole,
oh agaliba,
enjole.
Ati toba kona chungamba, jango muziki tugusambe. Gambe toba kona chungamba, jango enu tuichangi.
Aye le 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 le,
enjole,
le 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 le.
Lekanzine, nenzina mumama, mulamu wachisera, ato muziki zuri sana. Lekanzine. Zina
Bawa.
Wepa! Ça c'est la techno soukous. Ah oui, Lolongomba, le propriétaire de tous les dossiers. Hey! 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 Avec la participation de Jocelyne Berroa.
Attention, ça va décoller.
non lui.
Je m'appelle Coupé Coupé Bibamba.
Non l'autre. Préparez-vous, car les bonnes choses ne durent jamais. Attention, le top des tops revient en colère. Bombe Kirana Souké au Chile. Bombe Kirana à la Chipapa. Koutoukoutou Kayana. Koutoukoutou mon bébé. Koutoukoutou Kayana. Koutoukoutou mon bébé. Koutoukoutou Kayana. Come on, come on.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. So this is how President Blaise Compaoré of Burkina Faso finally met his Waterloo. After being in charge of his country for 27 years, he was greedily making an attempt to change the country's 2000 constitution to facilitate his contesting for the fifth time the presidential election set for next year. That was too much for the majority of the people of Burkina Faso. As the parliament met in session to change the constitution last week, they came out into streets in very large numbers to register the strong opposition. In the past few months, journalists, publicists, and even senior government officials of the Western world talked glibly about the power of the people during the so-called Arab Spring. But what the international community witnessed last week in Burkina Faso represents a genuine revulsion against the concept that African presidents should defy the people to stay in power in contravention of their constitution. When it became clear that some elements of Compaoré's army were allowing protesters to enter parliament and to burn it down and other government buildings, the president realized that finally the die was cast. After many peaceful citizens have been killed, he made a futile attempt to preserve his presidency. He called for a state of emergency and a transition government that he would lead. But a joint protest declaration by 34 opposition leaders made it clear that only the resignation of the president would restore peace and tranquility to the country. President Kapolei finally understood that he must go. He resigned and left a political vacuum which was filled by the Army Chief of Staff, who declared that the presidency would now be held by him. However, there is a need to make some clarifications. The departing Kambore had said that there would be a 90 days period of transition to arrange for new elections to restore democratic order. However, the Army Chief of Staff said that there will be a 12-month transition period. It is known that the Army Chief of Staff, who now takes over, was an aide of the president. He is not the first choice of the people, but if he acts properly, he might be acceptable. Now, however, it seems that there is a power struggle in the army. Is it General Honoré Touré who is in charge, or is it the man who is the second in command of the presidential guard, Colonel Isaac Zidane? This needs to be clarified urgently. The example that needs to be followed is what happened in Niger in 2010 when the army took over and prepared a transition to a democratic rule for the country. Hopefully, the embarrassing manner in which President Traoré, President Compaoré, has vacated his position would be a lesson to many African presidents who may be contemplating changing the constitution to prolong their rule. It is also to be borne in mind that the fact that a president has close relationship with Western powers, such as the case of Kampore with France and the United States, will not prevent him from the wrath of the people. President Kampore, who remains suspect to many young Africans throughout the continent for the mysterious death of Sankara, and who has been implicated in the civil conflicts in Sierra Leone and Liberia, has tried in recent years to burnish his tarnished image and reputation. He is now seen as a peacemaker in the continent. Adieu, Mr. Kampore. Beware African leaders. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And that was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. We'll be right back. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Shegun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Bill Barber, we say thanks for joining us and ask the elders say, if the cockroach wants to rule over the chicken, then it must hire the fox as a bodyguard. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Winter is on Syria's doorstep. For millions of the country's civilians, this means that an already difficult existence will become much, much worse. They must winterproof their shelters or build new ones, but building materials are scarce. Most of the refugees need cold weather clothing, extra blankets, and heating fuel, all of which are in short supply. And many worry about procuring medicines for their children's common winter illnesses. According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, of Syria's population of 22 million, at least 6.5 million people are internally displaced, while about 3.2 million have fled to neighboring countries. And as fighting in Syria escalates, these numbers continue to grow. Syria used to be a middle-class country where nearly every child was in school. In 2008, Syria's people were hosting refugees from neighboring countries, said Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration, Ann Richard. I never imagined that this land, so rich in history and antiquities, wheat and olive trees, could be so utterly broken. The Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees estimates that at least $6.5 billion is needed to meet these people's needs through the rest of the year. The United States is heeding the call, as it has over the past 3 years. Just 1 month ago, Secretary of State John Kerry pledged nearly $500 million in new assistance for humanitarian relief to Syria and for those countries that are hosting Syrian refugees. The majority of these funds will go to UN agencies. And in late October, Assistant Secretary Richard announced that the U.S. will provide another $10 million to help address the needs of local communities hosting refugees from Syria. More than half of Syria's refugees live outside of traditional refugee camps. This brings the total U.S. humanitarian contribution to the Syrian crisis to more than $2.9 billion since the beginning of the conflict. It is the largest sum we have spent on any humanitarian response in a generation. The United States is committed to providing relief for the millions of people affected by the worst humanitarian disaster of our era, and we hope that other nations will follow our lead.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.